Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, U.S. participation in the First World War was a milestone for this country. How did that experience during the World War affect the attitudes about the U.S. Navy at home, and how did it impact Navy planning?
Well, that's interesting. The general American attitude about our participation in World War I after it was over tended toward a sense of disillusionment. We seemed to gain little from the war. There was a strong sense in a large part of the population that we shouldn't have done it. You'll recall that we, after all, did not ratify the Versailles Treaty, did not join the League of Nations, which had been Woodrow Wilson's major contribution to the treaty. And there was such a sense of disillusionment that, in fact, the United States officially and legally ended its participation in World War I in 1920 when Congress simply repealed the Declaration of War. That's kind of a metaphor in a way, because it suggests the extent to which the United States, instead of feeling a shared triumphalism with its European allies, felt a sense of, what was the point of this? Why did we do this? Why did so many young men have to go overseas? Why did so many of them have to die? So there was a kind of reemergence of a quasi-neo-isolationism attitude among Americans in the 1920s. They returned to, well, famously, of course, the Roaring Twenties, you know, gin and jazz and so forth, but internal issues and attitudes, rather than conceiving of the United States as a member of the international community. Within the Navy hierarchy, the sense was, well, you know, if we're not going to be a part of the international peacekeeping mechanism, if we're not going to be part of the League of Nations, how are we going to protect ourselves against future confrontations? And the attitude seemed to be, well, we'll do it the way we always have with our own Navy, with our own fleet. And so the result of that chain of thinking was that we should go ahead and finish those ships that we'd started to build in 1916 with this fantastic, enormous 1916 Naval Expansion Act. We'll finish those, and we'll have a big enough Navy to protect ourselves from anybody. Most of those ships were still unfinished when the war came to an end, because once we got into the war in 1917, we discovered that, well, you know, the Allies don't really need any more battleships or battlecruisers. They need smaller escort ships to protect the convoys. So the big ships were left on the building ways, unfinished, while the nation turned to constructing escorts for the convoys. And when the war came to an end, there they were still, unfinished, sitting on the building ways. And in 1919 and 1920, we got back to work to finish those off.
As we worked our way through the decade of the 1920s, what was the general composition of the Navy? Were we still thick in the battleship era, and the battleship was seen as the principal yardstick for measuring a nation's naval power? And how did the U.S. Navy during the 1920s stack up to the other major powers?
Well, the battleship was still considered to be the queen of battle, certainly the queen of naval battle. That, of course, had been the dominant question in the years leading up to World War I. It remained the dominant viewpoint in the years after World War I. Germany's navy was gone. of course. It had virtually ceased to exist. It had been interned to the British at the end of the war, pending a resolution in the treaty. And the Germans suspected, rightly so, by the way, that the British were going to demand possession of the German fleet as part of the cost of the war. And so the Germans, to prevent that from happening, actually sunk their own fleet in the harbor at Scapa Flow, north of Scotland, where it still is, by the way, to this day. So the German high seas fleet, those dreadnoughts built in that frenzy of battleship construction in the years prior to World War I, the German Navy's gone entirely. That makes Britain the dominant naval power. But now the United States is going to finish this 1916 naval program, and that would create, in effect, a challenge to the British. So what looked like it might happen in the 1920s was a building race, nonsensically, between the United States and the British. And to prevent that, the United States sponsored a naval disarmament conference in Washington, began in 1921, continued into 1922, and the result was a 1922 treaty that rather famously ascribed limits to the battleship fleet of each of the participant nations. The five big powers at that time, the United States and Britain, would each be allowed an equal number of battleships by tonnage, not necessarily an equal number of ships, but a total tonnage that would equal 525,000 tons. Japan would be somewhat less, a ratio of 5-3. Italy and France then would be at the next level down. And then beyond that, there was really nobody else that could afford to build a battleship. So among the great powers, there was this agreement that there would be a ratio, 5-5-3, 1.75, 1.75, designated the number of battleships or the amount of battleships that each great power would be allowed to have. The curious thing about that for the United States is that we didn't do it. That is to say, we did not build up even to the limits we were allowed to have in the 1920s, again, with the attitude mostly internal, our view that we really weren't part of this world power structure. We could kind of ignore that, save a few bucks, and not build the battleships we were authorized to build. So there was little interest in doing that. So the battleship remained the measure of power, and it was quite carefully measured, but we did not bother to keep up to the level that we had negotiated.
It seems counterintuitive. I've always found it interesting, and the 1920s is another example of this, that occasionally, it seems that as a Navy, in times of neglect and inattention and financial stress is when we can become our most innovative and really move forward in areas that in the following decades become so critical. And we kind of see one of those areas as the technology rapidly matured, experience grew, that in a way, if you pardon the pun, in the 1920s, that's when you can kind of say that naval aviation really started to take off. What were those initial steps that we saw in the 20s for the aviation side of the house?
Well, you're right. This is a confluence of policy and technology. The emergence of air, and now particularly naval air, plays an important role in the 1920s. And curiously enough, that Washington Agreement plays a major role in this, because one of the things that happened in making the agreement that we would not build a number of ships that had been laid down in 1916. We would simply stop building them, scrap some of those that had already been finished. Other nations did as well. But what happened was we got a special agreement written into the treaty that some of those hulls, still unfinished, could be used for aircraft carriers. Now, what's significant about that is that up until this time, up until 1920s, aircraft carriers were essentially small ships, 10, 12,000, 14,000 tons perhaps, that would carry 6 to 12 airplanes whose primary function would be to spot the fall of shot from battleships. Battleships could now fire 20 miles or more, so you needed an airplane over the target to radio back to the battleship. Well, you're long, you're short, adjust to the right, whatever it might be. So that was the primary mission of airplanes for a while. But now, that we're going to take two battlecruiser hulls and turn them into carriers, they become enormous. They become 40,000-ton vessels that can carry 90 airplanes. And that made them a legitimate strike force in their own right, not support for the battleships, but in fact, the capital ship itself. And the two that we built on old battle, well, not old, but discontinued battle cruiser hulls were the Lexington and the Saratoga. And by virtue of their size, they actually changed the character of aircraft carriers themselves. Our first aircraft carrier, by the way, was the Langley, built on the hull of an old Collier, the Jupiter. And the Langley could carry, well, at a stretch, it could carry 20 to 25 airplanes, perhaps. But now the emergence of the Lexington and Saratoga, that changes the game completely. And I guess the proof of this comes at the end of the decade, in 1929, during these one of the annual fleet exercises, one of the principal things the Navy did in the interwar years, particularly in the 20s and into the 30s, was conduct an exercise each year, each indicated by a Roman numeral, and the one in 1929 was Fleet Problem 9, Fleet Problem IX, to use the Roman numeral, in 1929. And this was supposed to be a test of the capability of two opposing fleets, and they'd war game this out on the high seas. And Admiral Mason Reeves, who had the Saratoga as part of his squadron, and I can't remember whether he was the white squadron or the blue squadron or whatever, but he decided to break the Saratoga away from the battle fleet and send it by itself to attack the Panama Canal, obviously a mock attack dropping flour sacks. But it was so successful, it demonstrated the legitimacy of using the carrier as an attack vehicle. And so this is one of the things that emerges in the 1920s. Naval aviation comes into its own. It's still tentative. There's still a lot of people in the Navy who believe that lighter than aircraft, dirigibles, blimps, if you would be the future of naval aviation. They didn't have to be refueled as often. They didn't need a carrier. They could stay in the air for longer periods. But it became clear during the 1920s that large aircraft carriers embarked with attack airplanes would constitute the future of naval aviation.
Another platform and capability that we saw being refined all over the place was that of the submarines. And during the First World War, we were pretty much on the receiving end of submarine warfare. But how did we view the future of submarines in the Navy in 1920s? And how did we view that future compared to, say, other nations?
Well, the United States felt it had less to fear from submarines than a nation like Britain, or for that matter, Japan, which are island powers. Again, the broad oceans of the Atlantic and the Pacific tended to protect us from overseas invasion. And submarines of the 1920s were still relatively short-legged. That is to say, they couldn't go very far. The idea of a European power sending submarines to operate off the American coast, which did happen in World War II, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later, seemed unlikely in the 1920s. It was just too far to go. So the United States did not spend a lot of time developing submarine technology. The first relatively modern submarine, the Narwhal SC-1, the first streamlined submarine of 300 feet, more than 300 feet in length, is launched in 1930. And in fact, at the 1930 London Arms Conference, the United States pushed hard to make submarines altogether illegal, to banish them entirely, like gas warfare or germ warfare. They would simply become illegal. That did not get accepted, mainly because the French and the Italians fought against it. They felt they needed their submarines as a defensive vehicle. But the United States isn't really heavily invested in submarines in the 1920s. That will change a bit in the 1930s. But I think, again, it's geography as much as the moral questionability of unrestricted submarine warfare is what played a major role in the United States lagging behind its European counterparts in submarine development.
And finally, Craig, as the decade pulls to a close, What did the Navy think about how it was going to fight the next war should it come?
Yeah, of course, most Americans weren't thinking there'd ever be another war. You know, the Great War had solved all that. We were certainly never going to do this again. But the Navy, taking a more professional and realistic approach, developed a whole series of contingency plans, which any nation should do in time of peace. What if this happens? What would our reaction be? Most of these, for that matter, all of these, were associated with different contingencies, and there was a color code that attached to them. For example, if a war was to come about between the United States and Britain, unlikely as that might seem, that was war plan red. If a war between the United States and Germany was war plan black, and there was and about 20 different contingency plans, but the one that got the most attention was war plan orange, which was the contingency plan for a war against Japan. U.S. naval officers in particular had looked upon Japan as a potential rival, certainly in the Pacific. Since about 1911 or so, even though Japan was on the Allied side in World War I. And so War Plan Orange develops through the 1920s, becomes increasingly detailed and sophisticated. There were essentially two options here. One was called the through ticket, the through ticket to Manila. The assumption of the plan was the Japanese would attack the Philippines, now in American possession. We would respond by gathering the fleet in Hawaii, steam across the Pacific, challenge the Japanese fleet to a battleship confrontation that would decide the outcome of the war. That's a somewhat simplified version, but it's pretty close. As they looked at this, however, it seemed that interim bases might be necessary to maintain, not only to refuel, but to supply and support the fleet operating in the Western Pacific. And so more and more, planners began to look at how could we get our hands on these bases, how could we seize these bases. And I suppose the principal figure in this is a Navy captain, I guess he was a major by this time, named Pete Ellis of the United States Marine Corps, who wrote an important article about the seizure of advanced bases in the Pacific for a possible war. And this is really what created the initiative whereby amphibious operations and the seizure of defended beaches by the United States Marine Corps became its principal mission. Up until this time, you know, they're still not clear whether their mission is essentially be shipboard cops to keep discipline on order or landing parties to discipline natives or locals who were harassing American merchantmen or whatever it might be. But now, in the 1920s, thanks in part to Pete Ellis, as well as General Lejeune, the emergence of amphibious operations as a primary mission in the United States Marine Corps becomes central.
And that'll take us to the end of the 1920s. Really appreciate it, Craig, and I look forward to getting the 1930s, which is a decade both economically, politically, and also with the world's military that has a lot of moving parts.
Indeed it does.
Thank you very much. Claude, as we roll into the roaring 20s and the general culture, we're seeing the music change with jazz coming to the front. Women's hair is getting shorter. The dresses are getting shorter. We have writers of Hemingway's generation that are coming to the fore. It really is a golden age in many areas because a new generation has come on, has come to power, has come into the marketplace of ideas, looking at new ways of doing things after all the experiences and the thoughts of the World War I decade. Over in the Navy side of the house, do we have another new generation of riders that are coming on in the maritime security arena that we can see?
We do, and I would have to preface it with your characterization of the period of the 1920s. You're correct in how the public was reacting to the post-war period. But I think it's important to note that during every period after war where the Navy is downsized, it has to regroup. It has to think. It has to innovate. Williamson Murray and Alan Millett, for example, were the editors of a wonderful book on military innovation during the interwar period. and how this occurs. I mean, we see this with, say, the USS Langley, which was originally the USS Jupiter, a Collier ship, and we've got those models. We've got both the Jupiter in her original configuration, and then how she was when she became the Langley with simply a flat deck and became our nation's first aircraft carrier. And they had to do this within the context of a number of restrictions, including the Washington Navy Treaty of 1922. So I think what we're really seeing here is the classic civil-military divide. There's a disconnect between how the public is reacting to a particular era and how the Navy and this junior officer corps that's coming up and the ones that have already matured over the past few decades have to react and have to think about the future. Some of the individuals, we have Edward Eberle, who becomes, he's Naval Academy class of 1885. He becomes the superintendent of the Naval Academy, and he becomes the third chief of naval operations. And he writes an article for Proceedings on the Elements of Sea Power and the Future of the Navy. We have DeWitt Ramsey, class of 1912, who writes about the development of aviation in the fleet. Robert Koontz, class of 1885, the first CNO to write for Proceedings. So it's interesting that we're starting to see this decade the CNOs, who we will become familiar with over the next 80 or 90 years, and CNOs still tend to write for Proceedings to get the word out on their position. We see a young lieutenant, John S. McCain, class of 1906, the first of four generations of John S. McCains to attend the Naval Academy, and this would be the eventually Admiral Slew McCain during World War II. He is the grandfather of U.S. Senator John S. McCain. John Lejeune becomes the first commandant of the Marine Corps to write about the role of the Marines in this particular decade in the future. So I really would caution characterizing the period where the Navy is similar to the general public's view. They are taking a very precise look at what their role is. You even have English professors at the Naval Academy like C.S. Alden, who writes a two-part article in 1920 on the wartime missions of U.S. submarines. So they are thinking about this and how that will change over the next decade or two. There is a television miniseries, a television show called Game of Thrones, and you know, one of the famous lines from it is, "Winter is coming." Well, even in the 1920s, I think there was a sense that winter was coming at sea. They saw this in the Naval War Colleges as they were developing war plans, as they had for the past couple of decades. So you're seeing now this maturity of thought. There were two clear maturities of thought, I think. In the 1890s, we see with the Spanish-American War, the class of 1873, the Naval Institute founders, who are now rising to senior positions within the United States Navy, and see the culmination of their thought happening with regard to Spanish-American War. Now you see the culmination of Stephen B. Luce's idea about a naval war college and putting some thought into how must we conduct war in the future? How, with fewer resources, might we be able to take on a superior opponent? And so now you have two, three decades of these classes that have been taught. You now have these people who have been writing for Proceedings for 10, 20, 25 years, who are now instructors or presidents of the Naval War College. So they have reached this level of maturity in the 1920s, where they're able to now set the stage for the 1930s and what will happen, in particularly with regard to the Western Pacific.
One thing Craig and I discussed was the fact in the 1920s, we saw, especially in aviation and to a lesser extent, the capabilities of submarines became more of a regular discussion in the maritime security arena. What do we find in the 1920s about the aviation and the submarine side of the house?
Well, I don't think with regard to aviation, it should be isolated to wartime operations. And again, I'll preface it with a more current issue. 10 years ago in 2005, the United States Navy and several other navies responded to a crisis, the crisis in Indonesia off Sumatra and the tsunami. And what we saw there was the advantage of naval officers who have an understanding and experience with logistics in creating water, in providing food from ship to land, and to support these humanitarian relief operations, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief operations. There is a fundamental component of logistics that you simply can't learn until you really do. And I would say that was the case in the 1920s, specifically with Richard E. Byrd. Byrd had was the first man to fly over both the North Pole and the South Pole. So I think we start to see other capabilities emerging that would enable the United States Navy to conduct either exploration, as they had the previous century with surface ships, to especially to the North Pole, but also for the next 20 or 30 years. And I think it would be a tradition that would continue specifically in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s with regard to the space program, and why the Navy was so dominant in this program, particularly since the Naval Academy was one of the largest sources for astronauts in NASA. And for this exhibit, for the Warrior Riders exhibit, we have the hand generator that belonged to Richard Byrd when he was down in his Antarctic expedition.
Well, Claude, that wraps up the 1920s for us, and that gives us a lead in to what, as I mentioned with Craig, is going to be such an incredible decade, regardless of what your specialty is, politics, economics, national security, defense issues, the 1930s. Really look forward to the conversation, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.